All right. Finishing up Ruth chapter 3 tonight. Now, I'll read, just for the sake of having it all flow together, pretty much what we covered last week through the end of the chapter. And then I actually have an extra comment or two on a couple of the verses from last week. But anyway, Ruth chapter 3, beginning at verse 6. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she said, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then, as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until morning." So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, "Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." And he said, "Bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out." So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How did you fare, my daughter?" Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, 'You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" She replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." All right. So this is all the good stuff, right? We talked a little bit, really, the last 2 weeks about the way things were worded in such a way that it kind of makes you tilt your head a bit, saying, what's going on here? And the meanings of some of the words do seem to indicate that. So it sort of builds up that tension, builds up that drama, if you will, as to what's really taking place. Now, something that I wanted to note last week but neglected, and it came to me as I was reading it again, in particular it was in verse 13. After the revelation by Boaz that there's another redeemer, he says this: "Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. If he will not redeem you, if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until morning." That's that second sentence, "if he is not willing to redeem you." That's actually not a good translation there. And it's interesting because when I saw it in the Hebrew, I was sort of taken aback by the word that was used there. "If he does not delight to redeem you," is literally what it says. And, you know, you sit there and you think, whoa, there is a little subtle message that he's sending here. Because if he will not delight to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you.
Is that delight in that one
too? No, it's not. It just is, "I will redeem you." It just uses a verb form of redeemer. So I will redeem. But it is implied because it's the flow of the sentence and the flow of the thought that there's a statement or a desire to delight in doing what is necessary to help her out. Now, whether or not that's delighting in her or delighting in his duty as a redeemer or both is not totally clear. But I just remember reading that and seeing that and how that stuck out to me and why the translation here misses that in the ESV. You have NASB.
If he does not wish to redeem
you. Does not wish. Yeah, the verb, it's just simply to delight in. I mean, and that's the common usage of the word in the Bible. When you see delight in it, that's really all that means. But here, for whatever reason, it doesn't translate it that way. So if he does not delight to redeem you, that's the wording.
Like when we give, you know, we're supposed to give tithes with delight. It's like a
yes.
self-sacrificial thing God wants us to do with delight.
Yeah.
And this is very self-sacrificial.
Yeah, and in many respects, at the very least, that self-sacrificial attitude is coming out here. He's delighting to do what is necessary for the sake of others. So that's at the very least. Now, he could be delighted in the fact that, you know, as he mentions earlier, the fact that, where was it?
She didn't go after the young
man? Yeah, there's that, and then also the other townsfolk, that they all recognized her quality. That you can almost get the sense that the word there could be used either way or both ways. That it would be delighted to redeem her because of the character that she displays. So you've got this going on, and as we'll see when we get to chapter 4 next week, well, the other redeemer's not going to delight to do it. He was all keen, and we'll get to it. He's all keen on buying the property until he found out there was somebody else involved.
The NIV says that if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, good, let him redeem you. In other words, he may not want to at all, but if he's willing to take on the burden, so to speak, it's a different way of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of playing with the Hebrew there, because the word duty doesn't occur there at all, things like that. Is that the 2011 NIV?
I don't know. It's off the Bible gate.
Okay.
I guess so.
It could be. I don't know.
Verse 10, what does that mean about this kindness is greater than the one you showed earlier?
Yeah.
Why is he speaking like that?
The earlier kindness seems to be his reference to her pointing out that she cared for Naomi, that she left home and family and came back with Naomi to care for her or be with her. And so this is now showing an even greater kindness. And the fact that she is doing, or really imploring him, to do his duty as of a redeemer for her sake and for Naomi's sake. And yet at the same time, she's doing no more than that. So. All right. So he says to her at the end of verse 13, lie down until morning. And she does. And again, that's, you know, lie down. That's one of those words where in the Hebrew, it very much has a double meaning to it. So the author is using a lot of plays on words here purposely to get us to really think about what Naomi's intentions were initially. So there you have it. So we move on to verse 14. So she lay at his feet until morning. And so notice the way the author words that. She lay at his feet. To make sure we understand, this is what she is doing. Regardless of whatever motivation may have been taking place, this is what she's doing. And again, showing her integrity. But she arose before one could recognize another. So, the opposite of dusk, you might say. the little bit of light starting to come out, but you still can't see, make out faces or anything like that. So, needless to say, she doesn't get much sleep here. Because when did this conversation take place?
Midnight.
It's probably maybe 5 in the morning now. That would be my guess. I don't know. I guess it's barley harvest, probably. But still dark, can't recognize one another. So then he says, still in verse 14, "Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." Now, it's interesting because there doesn't seem to be an indication who he's speaking to here. And the tenses and of the verbs and the persons of the, you know, "let it not be known." Who's he talking to? I don't really have an answer. It's just the way it's worded. Maybe he's talking to himself, or this is what his plan is. We're going to make sure that it's known that she was not here. Why?
Protect her integrity.
Yeah, protect her integrity. For her sake. So again, we see two individuals who are acting in a remarkably dignified way.
So nobody knew until somebody wrote it all down. Yeah,
probably.
And everybody.
The kids and the grandkids, oh, we laughed about that for hours, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know. But that would seem to be the case. At the very least, whoever wrote this certainly knew the story. So then he goes on and says another thing. "Bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out." So she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. Now, the question is, what are the measures here?
Well, their standard was the ephah.
Probably. Didn't necessarily have to be, but given the context of the story and the way things continue to keep building, it seems that that's likely the case, which means if that's the case, 6 measures would be about 80 pounds. That's right. Bigger than the first batch. That's right. So this ought to tell you something, because if first of all, you know, what actresses and actors would you get to portray Ruth and Boaz? You know, really, think about that. You know, she's no waif. Well, they could, but still, carrying around 80 pounds of dead weight on your back.
Can the movies just make that out of styrofoam?
Yeah, well. Yeah, out of styrofoam, but we realize how realistic that'll be.
Yeah.
Wait, Hollywood realistic? No way. So, potentially 80 more pounds to carry. And you notice that this was a bit much even for her, because so she held it out and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. So it was the kind of thing that she couldn't just quite lift up. This is a bit much. And since she's already standing, he probably just put it on her back and that would have been okay to do. Kind of like a piggyback. But to try to lift up, that would have been too much for her, apparently. I mean, that's the way I read that. But now she's got even more.
She probably has leftovers from the last one.
Yeah, well, she had plenty from before, that's right. And now we're at the end of the harvest, and much more is given to her.
This is almost like a dowry.
Almost like a dowry, and that's an interesting thing. Because people have some commentators, and maybe there's some merit to this, but it is at least worth noting, is the fact that he gave her 6 measures. And typically in Hebrew thinking, 6 is a number of incompleteness. We're not done here, is what he's saying. And so it was a bit of a statement to her, here's 6 measures, not 7. 6 measures, because business is not finished.
And I don't want to break your back.
Yeah, and I don't want to break your back. Right. Right, exactly. And so here you have two individuals who, I guess we need to be careful here. I don't think that this is what you would call a romantic story in the sense that we think of today. You know, it's not like he's whining and dining her. He's doing his duty as apportioned by God. And he's very generous with it. So he is going above and beyond. And she, at the same time, is showing dignity as well. So. He seems to be, but he's also willing to take a step back and recognize that if this other Redeemer will do it, then he'll step aside. And so he's showing the dignity even there. He could have kept it a secret. I don't have to say anything. But he doesn't, and we'll see that when we get to chapter 4. All right, and then she goes into the city. So she hikes down to the city or up to the city, wherever, into the city with 80 pounds on her back. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How did you fare, my daughter?" And that's not actually an accurate translation. Literally what it says is the exact same thing that Boaz said to her when he woke up. "Who are you?" Yeah, that's way different, is right.
Maybe she couldn't see her face because she was bent over.
Maybe, yeah, that's it. Just kind of hunchback, you know. That's right, she hadn't slept, you know, it's dark. She's probably all sweaty from carrying 80 pounds of barley.
Not a good thing before a wedding.
Yeah, no. But literally it is, "Who are you?" And so that has led to all kinds of speculations. What's Naomi saying here? You know, there's really no good answer to this. But I think it could be something along the lines of there's this sort of, you know, who are you really? Because, you know, she recognizes Ruth, but there's obviously something about her now. Because not only did she leave her family and country to come with me back empty-handed, and now she's coming back full again. But now Ruth tells the whole story of what's going on. And Naomi seems to almost have the indication that this is going to work out. No matter which way it plays, whether it's this other Redeemer or Boaz, this is going to work out, and it's all because of Ruth. Who is she?
Because she knows Naomi herself knows that if Ruth is redeemed, that Ruth will not abandon her mother-in-law.
Correct.
So she will be helped out in her old age.
Yeah. And really, technically, Boaz would be serving as a redeemer, acting as the son of Naomi. So it would be his responsibility to care for her, not just simply to be the redeemer to produce the children in the name of her dead son, of Ruth's dead son.
Could she be asking Ruth, "Are you now betrothed?"
It's possible. I don't know. I don't know if there's a Hebrew idiom for that. You know, who are you?
Yeah, to whom do you belong?
Yeah, and I'm not so sure because I don't, at least some of the things that I've read, my lexicons are not very good at Hebrew idioms because they deal with individual words. Like some words that are combined, they'll indicate. But I didn't seem to get any indication that "who are you" necessarily was an idiom for something like that. Yeah, right.
Like, so where are we now?
Yeah. You know,
that kind of thing. And it's interesting because in my version here, it says she told her all that the man had done for her.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's cool.
Yeah. All that the man had done. So, I'm curious which word for man that is. See, now that you bring that up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even still, sometimes it would just say all that he had done or said, which is common. So this is Ruth 3. And we are looking at 16. It's actually just the normal word for a male, or it actually can even be used for husband. It's not that impossible, but typically just male or man. So it's not the generic man as in Adam, but more a man. Now, whether or not they have the article there, that's a good question. Let's find out. Yes, it does. So, the man. So. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? All of a sudden, he's not Boaz. He's become the man. He's going to be the man. We know how it ends. Brooklyn Street, yeah, I hear you.
Who are you? Like, in your marriage, like, an angel, who are you?
Yeah, Naomi.
I was with the man.
Yeah. Naomi comes in.
Talk to your people.
Yeah, Ruth comes in. Who are you? Who are you? You know? Hey.
I'll be recorded.
It is being recorded. Did you get that? Yes. All right, so. Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, 'You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" Now, do you see the significance of that statement? You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. Why is that so significant?
Because then she might think something went wrong.
Well, no, not quite that. The emphasis on the fact that she must not go back empty-handed.
Naomi had come from the foreign country.
That's it. Naomi returned from Moab empty-handed, and she was bitter. So therefore, she said to everyone, "Call her Mara." Now Boaz is saying, "You must not go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed." So she's no longer empty-handed.
No kidding.
Yeah, 80 pounds. That'll last for a while. Hope she likes barley bread. So, but there you have it. So there's the significance of that statement. You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. She replied, this is Naomi now speaking, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." He's not going to wait. And as we move into chapter 4, we'll see that's exactly what takes place. And all indications seem to be that it's the first thing in the morning. So he wastes no time, and Naomi is confident that that's exactly what's going to take place. He will not rest. He will make sure this is dealt with, one way or the other. And so now Naomi knows that one way or the other, she's going to be cared for. No longer empty-handed. Cool stuff, huh? And yet this is precisely how God deals with his people. Even in the lowest depths of despair that we could find ourselves in, the Lord provides in his own way, and provides in such a way that glorifies himself and advances his kingdom further and further. Now, that's not to say in the lowest depths of despair in your own life, you're going to result in having a king be born from you. Okay? So we've got to be careful there. I'm not saying that. Could that happen? Well, if somehow this country becomes a monarchy, I suppose. But let's be real. We can't expect that. But the reality is it's a reminder to God's people that he cares and is faithful to his covenant promises. That's what this all boils down to, is his steadfast love and faithfulness for his people, even in the worst of times. And that coincides so nicely to Psalm 121 that we looked at this morning. "My help is in the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth." He is Israel's keeper. The Lord is your keeper. And he certainly was Naomi and Ruth's keeper. Any other thoughts or comments?
In 18.
Yeah.
How the matter turns out is, according to the NASB, how the matter falls, literally. Is that kind of a reference to the lot?
It certainly may. Let's see. To settle the matter. Well, to be finished or completed. He will not rest, but will...
No, the first part before that.
Oh. Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out.
Yeah.
Okay. And she... To her... Well, if it is, I don't see the word that normally falls. So you have the deed, the matter. Oh, it is. Yeah, how the matter falls. It certainly may indicate lots, even though the word lot is not there, mm-hmm. but how this will all fall out.
That's like a providence one.
Yeah. Yeah, it does have... Right. I mean, fall, the word, it's a common word that's used, but it, you know, kind of like keeper this morning, you know, keeper had this wide range of uses to like just tend as opposed to just guard. So it had this broad meaning. Well, fall does too. Fall as in fall of nations. The nations fall, they collapse, they're defeated. Or like this, where the lot falls. So... So somewhat idiomatic there, too. And you notice that the man will not rest. That's another aspect to this. He will not rest until he can give her rest. More integrity. There you go. Oh, that the church had more people like this, right? Both men and women. And we just pray, especially for those that lead the church, that that would always be the case. Always. It is the worst thing. One of the worst things when elders and ministers fall. Because they fall the hardest. And you think about that, you know, the expression, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. Well, yeah, that makes sense. And the larger catechism speaks of the aggravations of sin. And one of those aggravations has to do with the office that one holds. Now, we're not necessarily, it includes the office that a church member has, but even an office of general believer, all of us hold that office. Okay, but where are they in rank in their life of the church? And so when you're talking about an elder or a minister that falls, and they fall hard, and usually... You know, when they fall fighting and kicking and screaming, which is even worse because it just drags on and the people end up hurt the most. Oftentimes, churches, congregations divide over it and people leave the church because of it. It's just horrible to witness these things when they happen. And so now, you know, I am in constant prayer for the Presbytery of the Northwest. Did you guys hear that? I hope you guys up there are listening. Because there is a situation up there on a doctrinal matter that has gone beyond doctrine. One church has left. Another man has called somebody else asking if GA would redistrict the presbytery on something other than geographical lines. And I'm thinking, that's bad. If they're asking this, this is bad. There is nasty infighting going on there. Now, thankfully, there is a committee set aside to deal with some of those interpersonal relationships, but they still don't always end well. And it takes time, abundant time, and it is sometimes painful. So, pray for the ministers and the elders of the church. As a minister, please pray for us constantly. We need this kind of dignity of Boaz and Ruth. Any other comments, questions? I'm going to take that silence as a no. Why don't we close in prayer then?